My name is Tim Ingold, and I'm an emeritus professor of social anthropology at the University of Aberdeen. And I would like to take a bit of time to say a few words about sound. And our first question, of course, must be what we actually mean by sound. If you ask a physicist, they will tell you that sound consists of mechanical or longitudinal waves conducted through a medium, such as air, and that these waves travel from a source, a vibratory source, to a recipient that could be your ear. But in the physical sense, a sound can exist regardless of whether any ears are around to pick them up. They're simply the mechanical vibrations being conducted through a medium within a certain range of wavelengths. Ask a psychologist, however, and they might give you a slightly different answer. They might say that no, sound is actually what we hear. It's something that we register within our own minds on the basis of an input of sensory data from the ears to the brain. But the sound is something that is registered in the brain. It's not something that is out there in the world. So we seem to be faced with a choice between two senses of what sound could be. Either it's a purely physical phenomenon, or it's a purely mental or psychic phenomenon. Both answers depend on our making a rather rigid distinction between the physical world out there and the mental or psychological world, as it were, in here, as though there was a really fundamental boundary between the mind and the world. But I would argue that that's not how it is in our experience. And sound is, first and foremost, a phenomenon of experience. When we're listening to sound, we're in a sense hearing our own awareness of it, so that in some sense sound and hearing are one and the same thing. But that hearing is not an inner mental sensation. It's rather something that happens when the boundaries between the mind and the world seem to collapse or fade away altogether. So let me give you an example. We are often given a kind of thought experiment which goes like this. Suppose a tree falls in a storm, lands on the ground with a great thud. Then the question is, would there be a sound? Would the tree make a sound when it falls if no one is around to hear it? And of course, the physicist will say, yes, it makes a sound because waves are emitted. And the psychologist would say, no, it doesn't make a sound because there's nobody to pick it up and process it in the mind. But let us now imagine that we are out there. Instead of conducting this rather abstract thought experiment, let's imagine that we're actually out there in the world, in the forest, and a storm is going on and a tree falls. And in the moment of that tree's falling, we are completely caught up in that event, maybe unwillingly, but there we are, swept up in the event of the tree's falling. And we feel it really inside, in our guts. We feel this tremendous sound, and it seems to take us over, as though we and the tree were for a moment bound up together in this extraordinary event. So when we hear the sound, it's not as though the tree was emitting the sound as a package of which then arrived at us and we thought, oh, that must be a tree falling. It's rather that in hearing the sound, we become participants in the event itself. And that's what the sound itself consists in. Or perhaps to give another example, again, you're in the forest, a storm is going on, and there's thunder and lightning. And you hear this great rumble of thunder. And again, the physicist will tell you that, well, this thunder comes from a particular source. There's a kind of explosion, which then travels from the source to your ears. And we know that it takes a certain amount of time for thunder to travel from the source to the ear. That's in the physical sense. But as you listen to the thunder rolling away, that becomes an event that carries on with a duration of its own, in the real time of your own experience. So we have to distinguish between two senses here, or two lines of sound, if you will. There's the line of transmission that connects the source in the thundercloud to the recipient, that is your ear. And conventionally, we might draw that as a kind of straight line from one to the other and say, yes, it takes a certain amount of time for the sound waves to travel from one to the other. But that's one line of sound. But the other line of sound is the actual evolution of this sound in real time, in your own awareness, in your own consciousness. And that's the kind of sound that I'm talking about. It's the kind of sound that arises when our own awareness meets and mingles with the real-time unfolding of a cosmic event. It's where the affective merges with the cosmic. And in that sense, I would say that sound is neither physical nor mental, but atmospheric. So let's treat sound as a phenomenon of atmosphere, as the underside of our own experience of hearing. And then ask, well, what does that mean for our understanding of the ear and of the body? Because we can no longer think of the ear then simply as a receptor organ that is picking up signals from a source and sending them to the brain for processing and interpretation. Rather, in a sense, the ear signifies the attentiveness of an entire body that is, so to speak, on oral alert, that is alert to everything that is going on in your surroundings. So instead of being a body with ears, you become something like an ear body. Your whole body becomes an antenna that is reaching out and attending to this unfolding of the events in the storm that is going on around you. So we have to think of the body then not so much anatomically as something like a bundle of affects. Just to give you an example of what I mean, let's take that famous episode in Shakespeare's play Julius Caesar, where Mark Antony makes a speech. He gets up on the podium and he says, "Friends, Romans and countrymen, lend me your ears." Now, obviously, he doesn't mean that everybody should cut their ears off and give them to him. What he means by "lend me your ears" is that please give me a voice. That is, that when I open my mouth to speak, let it be heard. And in lending their ears, he means he wants those people in the audience to stretch out their oral attention towards him so that he can have a voice, so that it may be heard. And I think there's something very fundamental about this, because then it shows that sound and hearing not only become ways in which we participate in a world. We're not just consuming sound, picking it up and interpreting it. We're complicit in its very production. But by lending our ears to the world that surrounds us, we are actually giving that world a voice. So it's not as though when we listen to the sounds of nature, for example, it's not a way of our taking possession of it. It's rather a way in which the world itself takes possession of us, and in doing so, allows us to lend our own ears to what is going on, and in that way, to give nature itself a voice. So the tree, if we go back to that tree falling in the storm, it's not so much that we are taking possession of the world, but it's the way in which the world is taking possession of us. The tree, of course, doesn't have a voice of its own. It doesn't have vocal cords. It doesn't have ears. It's just a tree. But in lending our own voice to the tree's spasm as it falls, we give that tree a voice that it wouldn't otherwise have. And I think that is really where the true meaning of sound resides. Sound is the way in which, through attending orally to what is the world that is around us, we are not only possessed by the world, but also give that world a voice so that it can speak to us.